Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today we have an exciting guest, Kiefer Zhang, and he'll be talking about token economics. So obviously Web3 gaming, super hot topic and really interesting in light of these things like Axie Infinity, obviously things like Steppen, so Move to Earn. So, you know, we're really starting to see kind of less experimental and more robust economic models appearing. And let's unpack some of these with Kiefer. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Miko.
Yeah, it's great. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess I can start with a little bit of a background on myself.
Yep.
So I'm an economics consultant at Economics Design. So getting to work with some pretty interesting AAA games in the space and figuring out what it actually takes to design a sustainable economy. I've been in the crypto space since around 2014. Previously doing some work around systems design for crypto game, figuring out some incentive design for crypto casinos and exchanges, but really excited to have landed myself in the Web3 game economy space.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's great to have you on the show. You know, we do a lot of thinking about, you know, Web3. We talk a lot about sort of economics, whether it be on the DeFi side, on the NFT side, on the gaming side. So, you know, I think really we're looking forward on this show to dig in very deeply into the gaming and Web3 gaming and really more about kind of how economics works and, you know, how these things can become more sustainable. So I guess we'd love to kind of have you unpack a little bit for us sort of what you think the state of the industry is. So where are we and, you know, what's happening now?
Yeah, so I'd say where we're at now is a little bit of an intermediary stage between a first wave of games and exploration about game economies, kind of the characterization around play to earn. It's been pretty well established at this point that this initial model is not quite sustainable, and we're seeing this shift where companies are trying to distance themselves from this very financial first or heavy financial focus on their game economy and moving much more towards a game first and play and earn or play and own, something where you're separating out these incentives. And this is going to allow a lot more focus on bringing in that traditional gamer. And so we're in a period where we're waiting for some developers to get a little bit farther along in the process. It's unfortunately a long development period in a lot of cases, but there's a lot of innovation going on in figuring out for these projects that are coming up, how should they be developing? How should they be shaping these economies? So from an economy design perspective, it's a really interesting period of creation and shifting around what a sustainable economy might actually look like.
Yeah, I think there's two really fundamental things at work here. One of them is sort of the network effects, right? So network effects, and I think when you combine network effects with speculation, you end up with these kind of crazy kind of growth bubbles, you know? So it's definitely, people talk about, you know, I guess I would call it sort of a Ponzi effect, right? But there, it's really, you know, maybe more of a pyramid, but the idea becomes that, like, the, you know, the economic activity is really dwarfed by the speculative activity, right? But the thing that I think is a really important hallmark in this era is free-to-play gaming, right? Which is, if you look at free-to-play gaming and you have zero crypto, zero blockchain, zero Web3, zero anything, just regular free-to-play gaming, the economic models have been made to work, right? So what we know for a fact is we know that free-to-play gaming works, right? We know that free-to-play gaming, at least for some games, is not only sustainable, but it's richly profitable, right? So, you know, so I think starting from there may be a really smart lens through which we can kind of back into a functional model for crypto gaming, blockchain gaming, NFT, and the rest. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and so kind of going to an even more fundamental level there, it's figuring out where does that value actually come from when you're launching a game? And then from there, figure out, all right, how do you actually monetize around that? And so looking at free-to-play as an example that we can build around is that some of the primary monetization methods are going to be around making some trade-off of time for money. So you want to get fast progression through the game, and you're willing to pay some cash to speed that up in whatever relevant method, or going towards some sort of cosmetic purchase. You want to get some kind of social status or just improve your general experience on the cosmetic side. And those are kind of some key methods that can be built around for when you're actually creating these more complex, for a Web3 economic model, figuring out how do you monetize that and create this real value rather than what's kind of been done in the past of having this financial motivation rather than gameplay, real value that you get from these sorts of fundamental value drivers. And there's also some interesting learnings that you can get from free-to-play around some external value injections, like sponsorships and advertising. Obviously, that's a really big part of the free-to-play monetization space. And there's some cases in Web3 that are starting to explore that. An interesting example of that is EV.io. It's a first-person shooter, and it's the quality is definitely not up to not competing with any AAA games out there right now. But it's just an interesting case from the economy side of thinking of how they have the value injection there. So they have a pot of money initially put up as a baseline amount by the project itself from its fundraising. But building on top of that, getting sponsorships. I know Magic Eden was one of their early sponsors here. Building out a network of supporters there that get some benefit from reaching their audience. They have like some in-game billboards. So just kind of experimenting with different ways that you can reach these audiences and monetize them, but have this outside money flow into the economy and then be able to be distributed in some earning potential there.
So I wanted to comment there. So, you know, as the audience probably knows, I'm a managing partner with Gumi Cryptos Capital, a venture fund. And one of our portfolio companies is Bling Finance. And their model is super sustainable. It's profitable and it's working just fine, which is what they do is they generate ad revenue in casual games, mobile. And then what they do is they actually pay out some percentage, you know, not 100%, but they pay out some percentage of the ad revenue back to their users in the form of Bitcoin earnings, you know, and so-called bling points, right, that they can use for in-game purchases, right? So to me, like, if you reason about this, then sort of play to earn budgets could be looked at as user acquisition budgets, right? So you could basically consider that the money that you're paying out to users is basically user acquisition money, right? And the idea becomes that you're shifting from a traditional channels like app store advertising for acquiring users to things like word of mouth channels, right? And one of the things that's really interesting when you look in places like the Philippines, where our other portfolio company Yield Guild Games, YGG, was born, you know, there's a couple of perfect storm elements in the Philippines, one of which is that, you know, the cost of living is fairly lowered in the Philippines. So it's, you know, making money, playing a game, the money is more impactful, right? I think the other thing that I think is really notable is that there's a very strong kind of word of mouth social network there. So I think the spread of it is really, really fast, right? So I think those are really interesting dynamics, you know, but I think the take-home lesson I wanted to impart is, you know, there are already, like, Bling Finance is a effectively blockchain play and earn game with a sustainable model that's alive and profitable today. So I just wanted to say, you know, it isn't impossible.
Yeah, and kind of building on that, I think it's important to understand or tie the specific model you're using to the core gameplay. Like, if you're taking something that is fundamentally like a casual or hyper casual game, you sort of have to go based on that outside advertiser spending if you're working in any Web3 components, versus like if you're, because if you're coming in with the expectation that people are going to buy NFTs, and it's something that if you just abstract away all the blockchain, if no one's going to buy, if it's not reasonable that someone would actually buy that asset for cosmetic benefits in a super casual game, then you can infer that the only reason they would buy them in a Web3 context is for the financial motivation. And so that's how you can kind of end up with some of these unsustainable Ponzi models, where there's this mismatch in expectation of why users are actually spending versus the type of game and quality of the game that they're actually building.
Yeah, I think that's very smart. I think the idea of economic input is basically the core, right? Which is, if you look at something really well built out, like the biosphere of the planet, right? Like, you know, there's an energetic input, which is the sun, right? So the sun is shining into the biosphere, right? And you get the result of like every meaningful pixel that you can see is basically the downstream result of constant input of energy, right? So if you look at a game ecosystem like that, the question is, where's the money coming from, right? And what's the constant input of financial energy, right? So who's actually paying in, right? So in the case of Bling, it's the advertisers, right? The advertisers pay in. And as long as the paying out is smaller than the amount paying in, then it's net positive, right? So that's sustainability, right? If, you know, to me, like what you're describing is a situation where really there's a deep dependency on mercenary speculation, right? So if there's a deep dependence on mercenary speculation, then the money coming in is really only coming in as long as the going is good. Right. And as soon as it turns the other way, then there's a rush, a flood for the doors. Right. So that's the problem.
Yeah. So, yeah, really important to figure out where that's coming from, why they're doing it, and also just what kind of users you're targeting as well. Is this are they there for the financial reason, the financially motivated people that are largely there in the current iterations in the crypto space versus more your traditional gamers? And there will be some mix between there of those audiences, but when you're figuring out and setting these incentives and figuring out who actually should be getting any sort of rewards, yeah, I definitely want to make sure it's targeted towards the whatever audience you're really aiming for.
Yeah, and I think you were talking about this idea of kind of paying for user activity, right? Now, if you think about advertisers pay, that model is a great model because what are the users doing that generates the value? They're paying attention. That's all they're doing, right? That's the only thing they're doing. Now, how much value do they generate? I mean, you know, if you think about the entire Web 2, like probably 90% of what we call Web 2, other than like SaaS software, is probably just ads, right? It's probably driven and fueled by ads. So like, it turns out it's not bad, right? It turns out, like, what I mean by not bad is it turns out that that's actually valuable, right? But I would say that the thing that's kind of interesting is more like UGC. So, you know, you were talking about things like, can a player exchange their time and advancement in the game? You know, so instead of grinding, can they move ahead, right? Now, there's two approaches to that, right? I would say one approach is the standard approach, right? Which are things like consumables. Right. So a game can be like, oh, drink this potion and you'll move faster or you'll hit harder or, you know, so then, you know, that's a beautiful mechanism because a consumable doesn't cause inflation. Right. Like you're buying things that just destroy themselves as soon as you use them. Right. So that's a really lovely mechanism. But there's another mechanism, which is sort of UGC or user generated content. Right. Because if you go back to World of Warcraft, there was kind of power leveling, where you could basically pay cash money and some like player, maybe, you know, most frequently in a place like China would like bring your character all the way up to the level cap, you know, and spend like maybe hundreds of hours doing it. But, you know, but you would get that result. So I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are about whether, I guess I would say time shortcuts should be player generated or should they be game generated? Or is there any difference?
Yeah, so I think it depends on how complex of an economy you're going for. And I think taking kind of lessons from EVE Online here is, if there's some sort of task or action in a game that you can allow players to provide rather than the game taking it and providing that themselves, the more robust of an economy you're going to get. You're going to create more potential roles, more things that people can do. And I think that's where some of the like long-term next generation of earning potential is going to be in like very complex multiplayer economies, being around like having that time money trade-off, but having it that be provided by the players themselves, because we've seen, as you mentioned, demand for that in a lot of traditional games. It was just done in a black market context, where they're trying to go around the game and someone is going to provide and fill that demand. But in this case, just moving towards legitimizing that and making that part of the economy and making this more complex and routes for people to take to fulfill it.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, right? Because it turns out that when you study biospheres, right, you end up with these really interesting cases for biodiversity, right? So for example, when you think about predator and prey, right, the predator makes the prey stronger, right? And obviously vice versa, right? So there's this kind of like different strategies, right? So when you think about like, so you were talking about things that in World of Warcraft were like, gold farming, right? So you would have gold farming players and then you have other players, right? So you're, that's a kind of like not sanctioned by Blizzard, right? The official game publisher, right? Whereas like, you know, in EVE Online, there are definitely a variety of niches or roles where people kind of compete. And I guess one of the things that's so interesting is that that supports a very strong diversity of play styles, right? So I guess to me, it's so interesting to kind of think about how you can expand your player base. You can get different types of people playing, you know, and I think ultimately the existence of this biodiversity creates like very, very interesting and complex game dynamics. And it creates kind of a larger addressable player base and different play styles. So that's a neat insight. Other kind of thoughts around kind of diversity of play style and diversity of economic activity?
Yeah, there's something interesting being done with Block Lords. They haven't released like very in-depth economic information yet, but I like what they're doing around having essentially different roles that people can slot into the economy. So you have like the very lowest level people who are farming, creating resources, and then just kind of stacking up additional levels of interaction. So this is like a medieval style strategy game. So you have like above that, like knights and then lords of particular areas and leaders of kingdoms. And so how these are all like interacting with each other and playing their specific roles around protection on the fighting side versus resource creation. And people can go on whatever path they want, see wherever they can fit into that economy. But it, in having these different loops, it creates additional trading opportunities for where people want to spend time doing a particular activity that they enjoy and can then make these beneficial trades with people taking these other roles.
So I love that model, and you know, people should definitely check out Block Lords and see what they can see there in terms of a wonderful, diverse kind of set of roles. So this is something that I call first class gameplay, right? And what I mean is that there are very specific actors in an economic system. Like one of the types of actors is what I call a time or devotion actor, right? Which is someone who just spends a ton of time in the game, right? And I think that someone who spends that time may be well suited to do resource collection, maybe things like combination. So combination is something like crafting, right? So creating items, you know, things of that nature. And they may skill up in crafting to the point where, you know, they become a master. Or they create, you know, legendary game items and things. So this is pretty well-known kind of gameplay style, right? And the thing that I'm always talking about, you know, obviously there's wealth actors that come in and just buy everything with real money, which I think from free to play, if 90% of your revenue comes from 2% or fewer of your player base, then that wealth factor becomes a super important player, right? And the thing that you don't want is you don't want what I call toxic interaction, right? Because there's a third class of player, which is like a skill player, you know, and skill players basically play, you know, skillfully, mostly through, you know, when I say skill, I'm really more talking about sort of the Twitch skill, right? Which is kind of esport type skill. Yeah. But there may also be a skill actor like in something like EVE Online, where their skill is manifest in things like building alliances, or their skill could be manifest in like strategy, you know. So there are a variety of different kind of ways to play as a skill actor. You know, even in the crafting branch, you could be a skill actor, right? And then finally, you know, I would say guilds are a novel class of actor that has their own kind of subclass of the wealth actors, but they also kind of have their player base, right? So in some ways, a guild is an amalgam, but I would say it's a unique actor. And then I would say another one that's really unique are the fame actors, right? So people like streamers or even bona fide celebrities in game have unique play styles. And the reason why I call this first class is because if you think about the way Marshmallow appeared in Fortnite, he did not appear as one of the Fortnite players, right? There was this hilarious stream episode where Drake, you know, the musician, jumped on to play Fortnite with another game streamer, and it was not that. It was entertaining because it was Drake, right? You know, and but he was really bad. Like, he was bad at the game, and it was kind of hilarious to see how bad he was. But like, the thing that was cool about Marshmallow inside of Fortnite is Marshmallow appeared as Marshmallow. Like, Marshmallow was a musician, and that's what I mean by first class gameplay, right? Which is however you want to play, you are given that style of play. If you want to play as a wealth actor, if you want to play as a, you know, a skill actor, you know, fame actor, however you want to play, like, you're given a first class way to play. And then the second kind of core principle that I'm espousing is that the interactions between these styles are non-toxic, right? That you know, the wealth actor isn't buying fame. They're not buying devotion. I mean, there's limited ways, like the gold farming thing, you could maybe create a way for them, but I think you want it to be mutual and you don't want it to be toxic or abusive, right? And I think you want to have things where there's honor. So I'll give you an example. An example is what if there's sellable items and what if there's non-sellable items? So if you craft a certain item, you can sell it, right? But maybe there's an item that you can craft that you can't sell. The only thing you can do with it is maybe give it to someone, right? So like, you know, that gives you honor because it's like, oh, I took 10,000 hours, I crafted this thing and I'm giving it to you, right? And as long as there's some kind of proof that it's actually the person who built it, then it has a special meaning, right? As opposed to, I have infinite money, I bought this thing, here it is, right? Like, so that has a very different meaning. Anyhow, I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts.
Yeah, and that kind of ties into some thoughts around like how to set up specialization in a game here, because it's important to have essentially these different roles that people can go down and allow them to have different paths, be it on something kind of touching the financial side or create or going after finding a specific kind of enemy. And so you have these different roles, like what you mentioned. But when you have some of these complex and economies with real financial stakes at play, trying to kind of think forward to what this is going to look like, and might kind of see some situations where you have to have these readjustments in how many players of a certain type that a particular game can actually bear, without having negative externalities on some of these other classes. And so you kind of have to balance between allowing players to go deep enough in specialization in a particular type of role that they enjoy, while still being able to potentially have like this market rebalancing to, well, there are too many people trying to do this specific thing. Maybe they're all going and mining a certain area. What is going to be the impact on the economy there? Well, the market forces are going to decrease the attractiveness of doing this particular action. And so you need to be able to have players be able to adapt in some sense and slide into some sort of new role if something becomes oversaturated versus feeling like they hit a wall and just end up turning to another game.
So one of the delicate balances in a game becomes kind of trying to balance sort of economically fruitful activity with kind of fun activity.
Yeah. Right?
Which is, and you know, part of this idea of funness is that there's kind of this weird mixture, because some of the economic activity can actually be kind of fun. Right. So if you kind of, because there's this feeling of gain, right, where you're like, oh, I'm getting this gold, or I'm getting something out of this doing this thing. Right. So like connecting these things is kind of complicated. Right. But, you know, I think you're right about, you know, so from an updates perspective, then it feels like game designers need to kind of have some wisdom in terms of the features. Right. So, for example, if people seem to be mining something, you know, and it gets to the point where the economy gets flooded with something, you know, maybe that behavior is an interesting behavior, and maybe the game designers need to create more opportunities for users to exhibit that behavior, but maybe that mines a different resource or a new resource or something that doesn't cause that activity to collapse. And I think that the designers need to kind of reason about whether the activity is purely economic or whether the activity actually has some fun in it. Because if the activity has fun in it, then they need to create more opportunities for the fun, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of maybe give more just mental context around like this mining example, you could look at like EVE Online or Star Atlas, of how you have kind of these interconnected economies where people are providing some sort of service that fits into the value chain. And so at the top of the chain, you have people who have demand for spaceships. But this is like, again, a time money trade-off of they don't want to go through the entire process of mining the ore, crafting the materials, getting the blueprint, putting the ship together. They just want the ship so they can go off and just play the game and blow up some other ships. And so there's going to be kind of demand for someone to fit in lower in the value chain, but there's not infinite demand. And so, you have to balance allowing players to have an enjoyable experience in being the miner who goes out to the asteroids and get those resources, but allow them to have some other fun stuff to do, as you said, in the case that there are too many people trying to do that at once and it no longer really starts to make sense.
Got it. Fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious about, like, it sounds like you're alluding to things like monitoring as well, right? Because as you kind of start to see this sort of patching and evolution of an economic model and a player base, right, you're seeing the co-evolution of mechanisms, player base, player behavior, marketplaces, you know, whether they be kind of player auction houses, you know, whatever, real world money auction house, whatever it is, whatever the mechanism is, these things are all dynamic and interactive, right? So I guess my question for you is, how does kind of monitoring play a role? And, you know, what are the kind of best sort of tool chain for this type of behavior?
And so I guess you first want to look at just how can you measure demand in a market? And so this is going to be looking at for any particular asset, be it say like the utility token in any particular project. So you figure out how much, based on the past data, how much are people actually spending on sinks for that asset to figure out, okay, this is essentially what the market can bear for the distribution. And then that's kind of can be your guiding principle on when you're working on the other side on the faucet. So how much can we introduce in the economy? You really got to go based off these estimates of demand based on whatever the sinks are in that economy. So the sink side is generally going to be an estimate. You don't know exactly what players are going to do or exactly how much they're going to be spending on these different things, but you can estimate it based on past data on maybe segmented by certain player types. Like this player type has I guess maybe whales versus minnows. Like, you know, these whales have a high propensity to spend on these time versus money or cosmetic trade-offs. And then figure out, all right, how many of those do you have in the economy? How many of the minnows do you have in the economy? And based on that and the changes in user base over time, understand what the forecasted sinks for this token or NFT or demand for a particular NFT is going to be over time. And then from there, figure out, okay, how much are we going to introduce? And I've actually been pretty interested recently in like figuring out how do you actually set out these the faucets for this economy, right?
Have you looked into like systems like machinations or like things where you can kind of get much more dynamic analytics and kind of model as well as monitor?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of machinations. That's something we do with a lot of our clients because for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a tool that allows you to very precisely build out all the different components of the economy. So you're saying this happens, this many resources are created, this many resources are pulled out of the economy, and then running Monte Carlo simulations on what the potential outcomes are. So you can kind of test out what the forecasted economic impact is going to be. So figuring out the balance for those faucets and sinks. But I'm interested in kind of like classifying these like levels of control over the faucets in the economy. And I would put it at essentially like three tiers of control. And these being having no limit on the number of people that can create assets in the economy. The example here being like the original Axie model, right? There was as many people as they wanted could enter the economy, get an Axie, and kind of be printing SLP tokens. And this was kind of a very low level of control for Sky Mavis because they didn't control the number of people who entered the economy. And so they didn't have great control over how much SLP was entering the system. But then kind of moving up a tier is creating a limit on the number of producers in the economy. And so this could be done through limiting the number of NFTs, if NFTs are tied to production. Like for example, here, Heroes of Mavia, it's a base builder game, kind of similar to Clash of Clans. And basically, if you want to be involved in the NFT, in getting the utility tokens in this case, you need to have like an NFT base. And there's only a limited number of those at any particular time. There's no breeding mechanism or anything for those to increase in supply in a way that's not controlled. And so the actual quantity of the utility token distributed at any one time, it can still vary based on how much these base owners actually play. And so it's more of a loose control. And this applies as well to kind of the new version of Axie, where they're not controlling it by the number of NFTs in existence, but they're saying you need to be within these top leagues in order to actually get SLP earning. But they're not saying we're going to give out this exact quantity of SLP per unit of time. It's still, if you're in this, you get it for every win. So you're still getting, it's still not exactly constrained how much is introduced into the economy. But it can now be a little bit better estimated. And then I'd say the third tier of control would be a situation where there's a very specific way of controlling exactly how much of an asset is introduced in the economy. So, for example, if Axie at the end of the season, we're distributing this quantity of SLP based on your ranking. And then they would know exactly how much entered the economy versus an estimate based on how much players play.
Would this kind of throttling explain kind of the step-in kind of entry gate, right? So they're sort of allowing a limited number of players in, at a given time, right? So this is that kind of a natural throttling mechanism, or how do you see a mechanism like that?
Yeah, so Steppen was kind of going into that, what I specified as the second tier there, of they're limiting the number of producers. They weren't, it was only like kind of a soft limit there, because you could still create like more and more of the shoes, and it was still like not strong enough of a control at all. That was more of it delayed the inevitable Pontynomics there. But it was a step in the right direction for given that model.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
Good. I'd be curious if you're seeing other interesting game models, you know, any interesting nuggets coming out of any other examples that you've seen.
Yeah. And so a pretty recent one is Sparkadia or Eden Brawl. So they fit into essentially this top tier of having really solid control over the asset production. To give some context here, the company is called WorldSpark. Their overall hub world is called Sparkadia, and the first game in the ecosystem is going to be Eden Brawl. So a lot of different titles there. What they're building out there is essentially an ecosystem of a bunch of AAA games, starting with a MOBA brawler. And so building off of that, we worked with them in economics design to create this model really with the goal of moving away from a financial focus in setting out the economic model in a game. And so being in such a way that's actually approachable to kind of these core gamers. And so one of the interesting mechanisms for this was the creation of a asset distribution model based on a raffle system. So essentially players play any of the core games. So like you play Eden Brawl for a while, and then that progresses you on a battle pass. You hit milestones on a battle pass, and you get some raffle tickets as the reward for that. So with this, you enter your raffle tickets into a reward pool, and then you can get kind of a chance at this randomized payout. It could be off-chain cosmetics, could be some NFTs, could be some locked tokens. But a really key thing here is that it's separating it, or one, it's creating this very specific control over how assets are entered in the economy, because the team specifies for each one of these raffle drawings exactly how many NFTs, exactly how many tokens are going out to users. So they have this very granular control over the long-term evolution of the economy. And also an interesting kind of behavioral switch versus Axie, where like with Axie, you have, you do this action and then you immediately get this SLP result. So you can say, it takes me this long to play a match and I'm going to get this amount of SLP tokens. And so you kind of can weigh out this, this time and money output there. And that's how you get kind of this play to earn feeling.
Yeah.
But if you're segmenting these and making it, and kind of abstracting it, you don't have this immediate, oh, here's my financial reward for this. And the randomization also makes it not expected. So now I think this is a model where you actually get that separation between the gameplay and the financial component, and doing it in such a way that it doesn't, that you don't have the financial side undermining the intrinsic desire to actually enjoy and get into the game.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you're describing as well is that it maybe has a close cousin to things like the loot box, where you have kind of an intermittency of reward or variable reward that kind of creates maybe more persistent behavior. You know, so people do kind of like the dopamine hit of opening something with a random reward element.
Yeah, that's a big part of it too. Just kind of a better gameplay experience there. And it also, in doing it in such a way that is approachable for mainstream gamers as well. So it's, you're not like paying anything for access. to the loot box, or you don't have to. I won't get too deep into the details there, but you can have kind of this free to play on ramp into and an on ramp of not having any knowledge of blockchain, and just from playing this game, happen to win an NFT and kind of get this soft, easy introduction into the NFT side of things that otherwise might be kind of scared to do if they were presented from the start with this kind of financial, oh, play and earn focus to the game.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, from a disclosure perspective as well, like I'm an angel investor in WorldSpark Studios and Eden Brawl. So, you know, I'm definitely familiar with that ecosystem. I think it is kind of part of a sort of second or third generation coming out that kind of has a much more AAA play quality, you know, and a much more kind of world-class development team. So it's definitely interesting to see such actors kind of coming into Web3 gaming.
Yeah. Another kind of interesting model to pull out of there is what we did with setting out the currencies in it. So in the space so far, there's pretty much been very little deviation from having a one token model or a two token model. And that's kind of the baseline that you get asked a lot of, like, oh, which of these is it? I wanted to say that you can be a lot more nuanced than that, and really build out some interesting economies that bring in the Web2 side as well. So so with Eden Brawl, the model is having one on-chain token and then a hard currency. And so using that hard currency for really the core gameplay monetization, and also still tying it into the NFT component as a method for how you get, like some of the NFTs are crafted. And so that being an input to the crafting process. And so in that way, you have a very approachable method. And one particular thing to note there is that you avoid like taxable transaction issues on having this currency that's attached to the core gameplay. Because if you're trying to reach a mainstream audience, they don't necessarily want to have to deal with taxable transactions on a lot of their common spending around
that's
the core gameplay.
That's a very potentially messy issue, right? Because the thing that's so complicated about what happens next, right, is that when you think about things like resources that are mined, you know, is resources also become kind of bought and sold, right? So the thing that's interesting about buying and selling in-game resources is that the resources themselves effectively, if they're exchangeable for currency, become themselves currencies, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think to me, like, I'm a little scared about the kind of regulatory implications. You know, I think it's difficult for regulators to get overly heavy handed here, you know, but I think that it's going to be a bit of a battlefield.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning to me too, especially when you're talking about an industry that has a heavy target on kids as well. And how do you work out the potential for this financial implication on that audience? So a lot to be figured out on that side, but it's important for people designing these games and on economies to understand like who are you targeting? What are the implications of having these on-chain assets, both as a currency model and as NFTs, and making sure that you're at least making it as easy as possible with, like, for example, like with tracking tools, because I think that's going to be one of the things from the tooling side that needs to be worked out well, like having a solid translation to tax season. Because if you go through the first year of a Web3 game and then you hit tax season and you realize you have to crawl back through like your gameplay and like 10,000 transactions of all sorts of different random assets and currencies, that might make you leave the Web3 gaming space pretty quick. So that needs to be simplified.
Yeah, it's that is really disturbing, and it's sort of funny to think about. So in terms of like novel mechanics, you know, innovation, things you're excited about, you know, tell me what you think the future holds.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more adoption of having mixed models where you're taking Web 2 components, Web 3 components, and finding this mix. So finding ways to have a hard currency game loop that takes some of the profit and ties it into a token game loop, or looking at NFT distribution and seeing it as that it doesn't have to be all or nothing. So your assets, you don't have to go have everything be NFTs. You don't have to have everything be off chain. You can have some sort of mix. I think that's the best path there in general for having something that can be very targeted towards what the actual level of demand is for that asset. Also just a lot of innovation around how you can give different roles to players, as we mentioned before there. And going much more towards these like MMO models, now that you have this better monetization method that can really capture a longer tail of monetization, because we have we moved a lot more towards free to play rather than like subscription models, because you can make a lot more off of targeting these whales, but that has kind of the negative impact of closed economies. But moving back towards creating situations where you can tap into this desire for social interaction in these really big, very interactive MMOs is very interesting. And now with the transaction-based monetization, you can get some price discrimination in it, and I mean that in a positive way, from users who want to trade these expensive things for the whales all the way down to the people who they don't play that much, but they can still spend a little bit on the items up to what they're actually comfortable with. And so it's much more inclusive on who can be involved and how you can kind of more sustainably make money without very exploitative monetization methods.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting to kind of come full circle to something like MMOs. I think one of the things that's very clear is that a lot of blockchainers actually came out of the MMO world. I think Vitalik Buterin once said on a panel, he said, you know, everything I ever needed to know about pump and dump groups, I learned on the auction house selling Netherweave, right? So very super clear World of Warcraft reference, you know, and in a way, like one of the things that's so interesting about the interface of real world economics and money gaming, AKA almost borderline gambling, especially with loot boxes, you know, and young people, is that on the flip side, another way of reasoning about this is that this actually is sort of a education on real world economics and real world economic behavior, kind of a younger audience who maybe like doesn't have another outlet for understanding and learning about economic theory and, you know, the interaction of economic actors.
Yeah. It's a really great implementation of it. Like for example, I say I got my degree in economics because I wanted to get better at trading virtual hats. So it really stemmed from the gaming side, and it kind of goes the other way too. Like right now or maybe over the next few years, I expect we'll see people going, that gaming has stuff to learn from the field of economics. But even farther on, I think it's going to go the other way too, the field of economics is going to have a lot to learn from gaming, because it's going to create essentially these sort of experiments that were not really possible to test out in the real world, and getting kind of understanding of some theoretical economic mechanisms that can then be tested. Like for example, like Harberger taxes have been a concept thrown around for years, or land value taxes, and we're going to actually start seeing ways to test out these theories in a metaverse context that weren't really possible before.
Well, so I want to double click on the hats. Like which hats were you trying to trade?
I was big into Team Fortress 2 trading, so got to get my unusual hats game up there.
That's kind of fascinating, actually. I don't know if you know this, but the Flow blockchain, which is Dapper Labs, you know, coming out of the CryptoKitties world, actually got started because of hats as well, which is someone had actually developed an application. I think it was something called like Hats on Cats or something. So you could take CryptoKitties and you could actually compose them with different hats. You could be like, oh, well, this CryptoKitty is wearing this hat, or, you know, so you could just swap them around. And it turns out that like this really unique combination of requirement for both kind of composability and performance actually drove the design team of the infrastructure away from sharding. Because they were basically like, as soon as you have sharding, you lose composability. So the question then becomes, how do you get performance without sharding, right? So then the Flow blockchain was actually born, right? So it's funny to think about the history of hats and to think about like how hats have kind of driven sort of design and economic behavior in blockchain.
Yeah, it's all about the social status there. You wanna look good in the metaverse.
That's good. I feel like I should be wearing a hat right now. Maybe a virtual hat. Maybe we can get hats in post-production and we can get the hats on us.
Yeah, definitely need that.
Yeah, excellent. Well, good. This has been a tremendous show. Like, any parting words of wisdom or any kind of cool economic nuggets to share before we close this one out?
Let's see. Yeah, I'd say just to anyone out there creating a game or planning out an economy, just try to be flexible with it. Think from first principles. Don't just kind of copy what's out there. Really think about what is going to exactly fit what I'm trying to build. What are my goals here, and how can I build something around it? Because I want to see you all come out with some great innovative new concepts, because there's so much still to figure out in the space.
Yeah, I love that. And just as kind of also my own parting shot, like, you know, I do think that a simple core loop that works and then iteration, you know, beats these kind of super complex things out of the gate. Okay, well, thank you very much. Another great episode of the Miko Bits Show. And, you know, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to leave them below or on the Twitter thread. And, you know, happy to hear from audience members, folks building or playing Web3 games, or any kind of blockchain related activity. So thanks very much and see you next time.
Bye. Thanks for having me.